Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Margaret Reynolds, a writer, critic, broadcaster and academic. She's currently Professor of English at Queen Mary University of London, having taught at numerous universities across the UK. Her research focusing primarily on poetry. Away from academia, she presents BBC Radio 4's Adventures in Poetry, and she's written for a number of national newspapers. A prolific author, too, her previous books include The Penguin Book of Lesbian Short Stories, The Sappho Companion, and Victorian Women Poets, an anthology. Her latest, The Wild Track on Adoption and Belonging, is a part memoir, part examination of motherhood, something today's guest learned about in great detail when adopting as a single parent in her 40s. Peggy Reynolds, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Thank you.
If I could just start by asking you about your own relationship with your parents.
Oh, you've started off with one of the most difficult questions, Georgina. I had, well, you know, a pretty, in some ways, conventional childhood up to the age of about 11, but it was an Australian childhood. And this meant that my family, I have a younger sister and two younger brothers. My family moved often in New South Wales because my father was a school teacher. And in those days, you could only get promotion if you moved. So we absolutely never throughout my childhood lived anywhere longer for 18 months or 2 years. So there was a lot of moving. And this is 1960s Australia. You know, if it moves, shoot it. If it doesn't, chop it down, which was a well-known saying at the time. And my father was, you know, stern, rather remote. My mother was very warm and always at home. But then when I was 11, my parents decided to move to England. This was a decision, a political decision. They objected to Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War and the introduction of conscription in Australia for young men sent to that war. So we came to England. So that was one big radical break. But shortly after that, my father just left home one weekend. Didn't say anything to anybody, just disappeared, took all the money with him. And my mother was very ill at the time. So that was immensely painful. And it's taken me quite a long time to come to terms with that.
Where are you in the birth order in your family?
I'm the oldest. So I was 16 when this happened, when my father left. My little brother, the younger of my two brothers, was only 8. So it was, as I say, very strange and very painful. It was something that sort of, you know, remained with me for a long time. And when I decided that I wanted to adopt a child, it was something that I really had to think about.
I wonder, though, if that experience had led you to being more maternal than most people who hadn't had that, hadn't had to go through looking after younger siblings.
Well, that is a very good point. Yes, I think to some degree that would be the case. I'd say that was pretty much the case with my sister too, who's 2 years younger than me, that both of us felt great responsibility for our younger brothers because suddenly my mother was a single parent and, as I say, not well. And I think the other thing that it did actually, and I remember when I was in the process of adopting my daughter, a social worker saying to me, well, you've got to remember that any child that comes to you will have experienced a similar loss, the loss of a birth parent. So maybe you can draw on that experience and make that a strength in your process. Mm. And in retrospect, I think that is something that was true.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that process then. And first of all, the whole decision to do this and to do it on your own.
I was in my 40s by this stage, my mid-40s, when I decided to do this. It wasn't something that had arisen as a question in my life earlier, in that when I was young, I was married for a long time. But, you know, I thought, oh, well, children can wait. And then I lived with somebody else, a woman, who wasn't interested in having children, and because I loved her and accepted that that was my life, I didn't worry about it. But then in my 30s, and it was quite young, I think I must have been about 34, 35, I suddenly had a really early menopause. And I was quite shocked at my emotional reaction to this because, you know, I'd made up my mind I wasn't going to have children, sort of. But suddenly I thought, oh God, I really can't even begin to do that now. That's over and done with. So when this relationship broke up, as I got a bit better and came out of that, that was not my choice. As I got a bit better out of that and came out of that sadness, I thought, right, here I am in this new life by myself. How can I turn this into a positive? How can I turn something that is very difficult and painful into something that's going to be good in my life? And the answer was that actually something that I'd left out that I really did want to do was to have a child. So that was how I made the decision to adopt, yeah.
But very, very difficult in Britain, even in this day and age, as a single parent to achieve.
Absolutely. You know, whatever you're doing, whether you're going down an intercountry route, which is, of course, something that has closed down considerably in recent years in comparison to the way it was in the early 2000s, or doing the domestic route, the scrutiny is intense and the questions that you get asked. I do have to say, a friend of mine who has an adoptive daughter says that social services begin with the proposition that you're an axe murderer. And perhaps I wouldn't go quite that far, but as a single woman, you're kind of even more suspect because they're sort of used to, what they're used to dealing with is married couples who have fertility problems, who want to create a family. And that's what they start with. So I was slightly odd in being somebody who was alone, had had relationships, hadn't worried much about being childless before. And all of a sudden here I was saying, ah, I want to adopt. So getting over that was quite difficult. And, you know, it simply meant having to say over and over again, look, I really want to do this. I've demonstrated this. I'm doing the other. Let me keep trying. If there's one thing I've got, it's resilience. I can keep going.
So tell us about that whole journey from deciding to actually meeting Lucy for the first time.
Well, I did indeed begin with intercountry adoption, which I should not have done. It was a very bizarre and weird thing to do. But I thought you start with a baby. That was why I did it. And I wasn't going to get a baby in this country because children in this country who are available for adoption are only children. They're not relinquished in the way they might have been in the 1950s. They only get taken into local authority care if they have suffered abuse or neglect. And of course, it takes a while to realise that. So such a child is likely to be much older than a baby. And in any case, because I was older, because I was in my 40s, the rule of thumb is that you can't be matched, you should not be matched with a child who is more than 45 years younger than you are. So given my age, that would have meant an older child. And I thought a baby. So I tried that route first of all. But I was disqualified from that from the start because most countries do not accept applications from anybody who's been in a same-sex relationship. So I then began on domestic adoption with an independent agency, eventually, because I had to persuade. I had tried several other agencies, but eventually I did. And that experience was actually really good. I had a really brilliant social worker assigned to me to do my home study and look after my case. And she was the one who actually, once I had been approved as a prospective adopter, who came up with Lucy and sent me this little black and white photocopied photograph and said, I think this is the child for you. And this was the first child we'd seriously looked at. And well, she was right. the family finders looked at four other families. So they looked at five families. But in the end, they decided that Lucy would be best off with a single mother and just have the full attention with no other children and have the full attention of that person. And I was approved as a prospective adopter in February. My social worker showed me this little picture in March. In May, the family finders chose me as the appropriate family. In July, we went to matching panel. And in August, I met Lucy for the first time.
And what was that like?
That is very bizarre. It's a very strange thing to go to wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to go and meet my daughter. But we're not talking about giving birth. We're not talking about a baby daughter, a child that has been living with you, both in your imagination and literally physically inside you for 9 months. We're talking about a much older child who has feelings, who has memories, who has thoughts, who has opinions. And she has been told that you're going to be her mother and you have been told that she is going to be your daughter and that's it. So it is very strange. It took me a little while to sort of get into the swing of that. And there was a particular day, it was a few days in, when she sang a little song and I thought, ah, okay, I get this. I can manage, this will be all right.
Adoption used to be for many years something that was hidden, that people didn't talk about. Children often didn't even know that they had been adopted. But obviously, with writing this book, it's something that you've decided to share with the world. Why was that?
Yes. Well, of course, you're absolutely right. In the old days, adoption was often kept secret. Children didn't know. That's absolutely considered terrible practice these days. Even if you were to adopt a baby, it is crucial to discuss with them. Everybody needs to know where they came from. Everybody needs to know where they belong and who they are and what their past is. As Kate Athey says it, who do you know who you are if you don't know where you came from? And of course, she was adopted as a baby. So that is completely inappropriate practice. Now, the sharing of it, that's an interesting point, because I was thinking about that last night. You know, Lucy is my daughter. She's absolutely my family. Her cousins think she's her cousins, my aunt, her aunts and uncles. You know, she's just one of the whole bunch of nephews and nieces. My mother thought she was just one another grandchild, and that is that. But we decided together, Lucy and I, that actually this whole question about the fact that in this country at the moment there are so many children, about 80,000 at present, living under local authority care, with the local authority as their corporate parent. Now, not all of those children would be available for adoption. They would be going back to their birth families at some point, perhaps, or some other situation. But so many children desperately, desperately need safe, consistent families. And we decided that as a political move, we wanted to make an intervention in that. You know, I'm not saying that Lucy and I haven't had our problems. We have, not to do with adoption, quite other things, just within our relationship. But we feel very seriously that this is something that we wanted to just bring out into the open. And that was a collective decision. We both made that decision.
And in fact, she contributes to the book.
She did. I, of course, I'd tinkered around with this book for a long, long time. I used to write down little scenes of things that happened to us when she first came to live with me. And I had that kind of version of the book done. And I showed it to somebody who said, yeah, don't you think Lucy should have a voice? And at this stage, Lucy was about 16. I thought, oh, dear. Anyway, I went to her rather in fear and trembling and said, how do you feel, darling, about contributing to this? And she sort of thought about it and she said, OK. And I'm so glad we've done that, because most adoption stories are written from the point of view of parents who go off to try and adopt. And the story ends when they take that child home, when that child arrives. But of course, that's only the beginning of the story. Mm. And so to move it from that moment, which is it's not a moment of pure unadulterated happiness anyway. It can't be, given the child's background and indeed what you've been through as the adoptive parent. But to move it on from that and on to what happens afterwards was very important to both of us.
It's very powerful reading. Do you think that if you were to go through that process again now, that society would have been more accepting, that it would have been easier?
Actually, I do. I started this, as I say, in the early 2000s. So that's 20 years ago now and more. And I do think things are different. In fact, I've been speaking recently to my local adoption and fostering team, and I have been very impressed by the social workers that I've met there. Quite a different kind of attitude, considerably different in terms of their recognition of diversity and difference, and indeed their applauding of it and promoting it. And also, I think that the whole system for adoption has changed quite a lot, as well as attitudes changing, and indeed social attitudes changing. People out in the world having quite different attitudes, yeah.
How does Lucy feel about motherhood?
She is very determined that she would like to be a mother. She's not particularly interested in being a birth mother. She feels that, of course, she's only 18, but she does feel that strongly that she could bring a lot to an adoptive child's life, and I think that's absolutely true. Lucy works at present for a charity based in London called Body and Soul, which is a fantastic institution and offers counselling and advice and practical help for young people, and indeed older people, but specifically young people, who are care experienced, who are estranged from their families, who have suffered trauma of whatever kind. And given her own experience, of course, she's very expert in this and very sympathetic and helpful with it.
Mm. And how much do you do around sort of lobbying for anything to do with adoption?
Quite a lot. I am a trustee of the Foundling Museum in London, which of course tells the story of how Thomas Coram established the Foundling Hospital in 1739. Now, this is of course quite a different situation from the 21st century. But in the early 18th century, he was walking into London from his home in Rotherhithe and seeing dead and dying babies on the streets because birth parents, for whatever terrible reason, simply could not look after them. And he took responsibility for that and said, what am I going to do? He didn't ask who was responsible. He said, what am I going to do? So he set up the Foundling Hospital to accept such infants into their care so that they would at least be alive and have some kind of prospect of a life in the future. Associated with that now, so I got involved with the Foundling Museum, but the sister charity is Coram, which is a children's charity. It runs the adoption services for many of the many local authorities now. It also runs counselling services and support services and legal services and all kinds of things for children in care. And the work that they do is truly amazing. So I have a close relationship with them and with the Foundling Museum too.
Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called The Wild Track on Adoption and Belonging. It is by Margaret Reynolds. Peggy, thank you so much for talking to me.
Lovely to talk to you, Georgina. Thank you very much.
The book is published by Doubleday and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the producer Nora Hull and to our researcher Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.